Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. Check out our website, themacguffinmen.com. We have recently talked about Jurassic World, The Man with No Name, The Man with No Name trilogy, Going Clear, and Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. And last week we talked about True Detective Season 2, a podcast that has been described as listenable. So check that out. Also follow us on Twitter at The MacGuffin Man. Also follow us or subscribe to us on iTunes if you so desire. And yeah, we'll just get to the theme song.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. And now, here are Alex and James.
And now that the theme song is over.
Who gave us the L rating on that True Detective podcast?
Somebody I was talking to earlier. He actually gave us a much more positive compliment on our Brick video podcast. He said it was really cool. So, yeah.
Sweet.
Yeah. So, I think the listenable thing was actually more of a joke.
Okay. Because we're not listenable.
No, not at all. Her voices are super grating.
All right. Here we go.
Yeah. So what are we talking about?
Harriet the Spy.
We are.
At long last.
At long last. A podcast 19 years in the making.
I twisted your arm. I cut your proverbial ponytail.
If I'm a character in this movie, I'm Laura Peters. Is that what this is?
I don't know. Who do you want to be?
It doesn't matter. There's so many options.
That's true. Yeah. All right, why is this such a long time coming?
I don't know. I mean, I feel like we've talked about this movie on and off again for quite some time. I feel like it's been in a variety of email lists that you've sent me over the years.
Yes.
And I'm very picky about 20-year-old kids movies that we do on the podcast.
I keep trying for them.
Yeah. Well, I think this is the last one. I can't imagine there will be another one that comes up.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's like this, The Mighty Ducks and The Sandlot, and now we're out.
Yeah. What is it about this one that it passes the test for you?
I've always really liked this movie. I've always kind of thought that Harriet M. Welsh, my apologies, has always been sort of a kind of a formative character for me. Like, just because this movie comes out when I'm 10, I have very specific memories of where I was when I saw it, what played before it when I saw it, and really enjoying it. And
what was it?
It's Hey Arnold. It's the episode, or I guess the half episode, where Hey Arnold's getting in a fight at like 5 p.m. And I think her name was Angela, keeps counting out the minutes until he's going to die. And I found that very funny. And then I liked the movie that followed it. But
yeah, well, as you said, you were 10. She's 10 or 11 in this movie. So yeah, it's not even just that you're a kid, but it's pretty much exactly where she is, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, watching it again this week, it really just drove that point home. This is a movie about a very stubborn, very private person who prefers to sit and watch from afar and then write about what they see in order to better understand their world. So if that doesn't perfectly describe me, I don't know what does, you know?
Yeah.
So, my theory has not been debunked.
No, not at all. Yeah. And your peculiarities about your food choices.
Yeah, exactly. Although she puts mayo on her tomato sandwiches, which would not fly with this guy, but
okay.
Yeah. But even that line where she says, "I can't help it if I know what I like, and I know that I like tomato," like, that sounds like a sentence I would say, you know?
Yeah, don't make this my problem that I'm telling you what I like.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know, I just I saw a lot of reflections of myself watching this movie again. And the other thing is, I remembered this movie so well that it's not a lot of it surprised me.
So, right. Yeah. Do you still enjoy it? Like, do you recognize, like, as you said, kind of watching it this time through, you understand kind of how formative it was, and it backed up some of your initial beliefs about maybe how you related to the character, but do you, watching it now, just enjoy it as a movie?
There's a lot that I enjoy, and there's a lot that I don't. Pretty much whenever it turns into a kids movie, I don't like it. But there's a lot of stuff that is more I want to say more honest than the average kids movie in here, specifically the way they deal with the truth and lies. I feel like it's more real life than most kids' movies. But, you know, when she's like, oh, it's spy time, and then we cut to this, like, montage of cameras tilting and her jumping on her bed and, like, popping open a suitcase of her her spy stuff and all that, that's less interesting to me because now I'm an older person, so I'm no longer a child.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny because those are the things that, you know, those scenes you're describing with the weird angles and the quicker cuts, which aren't even that quickly cut now that I watched them.
No. They're 90s quick cuts.
Yeah, they're 90s quick cuts when they're still splicing together tape by hand and steam.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, those scenes are what, you know, I would guess are put in there to keep the kids interested. And now it's kind of the opposite for you. Those are the scenes where they lose you. But, the rest of the stuff still holds up for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also really enjoy it. The first hour of this movie is kind of plotless, you know, and I find that really interesting. Like, there's a very loose we're going to school and existing at school sort of plot. Like, nothing really, it doesn't really seem to have a propulsive narrative, really, until the notebook gets lost. And I enjoy the first half of this movie much more, and I think it's specifically because there's less of a plot. You know, like, there's Golly leaves, you know, that's kind of the notable event that happens. But it's not really a piece of plot so much as just a character exiting, you know, which I know can work both ways. But still, I don't know, I just found it... It was like a mumblecore kids film for a bit, you know?
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And just kind of looking at this structurally and reading people's reviews, some people kind of said the same thing in a more negative tone, that it, you know, the pacing's just off and there's not really anything moving it forward for large portions of time. And you know, that's kind of something they disliked about it, but something you seem to enjoy about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I can understand how in the 90s that would also be more of a problem, whereas now that might kind of be seen as a positive just because of the way filmmaking has changed. But
well, do you want to elucidate on that point at all?
Well, just that, I mean, I mentioned mumblecore, just that these types of movies are kind of more accepted now. I don't even know. Like, these movies about nothing, you know? Like,
well, like
movies Napoleon about minutia.
Napoleon Dynamite can get away with getting huge, too.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Napoleon Dynamite doesn't really have a plot. Yeah, that type of thing, you know, whereas 20 years ago, it was still, you kind of still felt like you needed a classical plot, I suppose. Okay. And most movies still have that, you know? But I think there is more blurring of the edges of that now.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll back it up a bit just to say, you know, some of the important things that always need to be said. Based on a 1964 book by Louise Fitzhugh.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, this applies to the movie. I've never read the book. It seems like it applies more to the book, which isn't surprising. But it was kind of a controversial book. It's, you know, a story about a strong female child who doesn't seem to want to conform to anything, is very independent, sneaks around on her own, vandalizes and judges people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it even got banned from a few schools and things like that. And how do you, as just on this book, on the movie alone, how do you see it as kind of a, you know, nonconformist, subversive kind of movie?
Well, yeah, I actually found that all that stuff interesting, actually reading about the book, because I did read the book when I was a kid, and I had very little to no memory of the actual book. The movie really took it over in my mind. But yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting to read, especially since one of my takeaways of watching the movie again was that it's kind of a movie about Harriet having an alternative lifestyle, you know, like, and the way that when her parents start talking to her and tell her that they're taking away her notebook and all that stuff. And it, like, it basically turns into a conversation where Harriet's point is that she just sort of chooses to live her life in a slightly different, uncommon way, and others can't really understand why. And the way that she lives her life is by staying afar and observing others, you know, and her parents are encouraging her to actually go experience things. And she's like, well, maybe I get my experience a different way from you. And she's kind of ostracized for that. And I found that interesting watching it again, and certainly applies to some of the things I read about the book.
Yeah. And Fitzhugh herself was a lesbian. And I think a lot of female readers who fall into the same category of kind of, you know, take a lot of solace in this book. It's just, especially even in the 60s too, there's just wasn't as much female writing to be found. You know, mm-hmm. I know the 60s wasn't that long ago in the grand scheme of literature, but, it is a very different playing field, especially now that you have the internet and you can publish a lot of stuff. There was kind of this subgenre that was the tomboy story where, you know, girls start out the way Harriet does, kind of dressing, you know, kind of androgynously and not being the Marion, you know, the girly girl.
Yeah.
And, you know, as you said, kind of just living a different way. And a lot of people have, you know, there is definitely, I think, that reading of the novel to be found because of just what I've read of how many people did perceive it that way. And sexuality is never really directly touched on in this movie, although it's all over the place if you look for it. I just thought that was a very interesting take that I didn't have in my mind watching this as a child, and then you can see it now.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is that a couple of the two things that I remember reading about the book that were pointed to is that sport takes up some more you know, standard female traits around the home, like he cooks and cleans and whatnot.
Yeah, he literally dresses as a female at one point.
Yeah, exactly. Which is certainly less weird for a character in a movie to do now, and also was less weird in the 90s than it would have been in the 60s. And also the way that Harriet dresses, everything that you're saying is correct, but it also just looks like how a girl would have dressed in the 1990s. Like, it didn't seem that that far removed from how a girl in 1996 dressed. So it kind of makes sense that these things wouldn't jump. I mean, also because we're 10 and 9 when this movie comes out, but it makes more sense as to why these things wouldn't come into mind from the movie, just because of the movie taking place 30 years later than the book.
Yeah. Yeah. And just, I want to go back on one thing you said earlier, and this is not to do with sexuality, but just that she has this alternative lifestyle, you know, just, you know, there can be a bunch of, you know, as they say in this movie, there's as many ways to live as there are people in the world, and yeah, some of them deserve a closer look. Mm-hmm. You know, as you said, she has this alternative way that she, you know, she just has her own hobbies. She does her own thing that people doesn't understand. And she's, you know, never intended to hurt anyone. It just kind of happened, like, you know what I mean? After their game of bumper tag, which... the goal of which seems to be to knock books out of people's hands.
Well, also, sorry to interrupt your point, but the reason that she loses her notebook is because she decides to join the traditional, like, what everybody else is doing. Like, she breaks from her alternative lifestyle. She's like, no, I'm not going to do spy time today. I'm going to join the kids. And that ends up being sort of a punishment for her. But anyway, continue on.
No, exactly. Like, I was going to get to something just like that. She has that offer earlier where Sport asks, you know, her and Janie if they want to come over. And, you know, she says, no, it's spy time. And then, yeah, this, what you're describing just with the game of bumper tag, she kind of tries to have it both ways. She tries to have her spy lifestyle and this, you know, normal childhood lifestyle. And, you know, I guess you just can't have it all. You can't have it both ways. And then, you know, as you said, the plot actually starts to really pick up when they read what's inside the book.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. How about visually watching this movie?
It's nice. There are some elements that I like that are just kind of, I think, just 90s filmmaking things that I enjoy, where it's, you know, when at the beginning when the teacher is talking about class president, she's like walking up and down the aisle, and it's in two takes, and they're both relatively long takes with camera movements and whatnot. And there are a few shots like that, and a crane shot down into the the guy that makes the bird cages, the cat man, as that cranes down from Harriet's face into his apartment, and then he pops into frame. That's a really nice shot. And there's just some good little visual stuff throughout that I attribute more to sort of the more deliberate pace of filmmaking in the 90s than anything. But I liked it.
Yeah, and it's even for a kids movie, even for a movie that came with an orange VHS tape, this is a very orange and very brightly colorful movie.
Yeah, an orange VHS tape that I should point out is sitting behind me as I speak. somebody wanted to borrow it from me like years ago, and now it's just been in my bedroom. It's so funny. It's the only VHS I have.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, but I mean that. The colorful thing, you can attribute to our director, Bronwyn Hughes. Mm-hmm. Or, as you said, that's just something, especially for a kids movie, you're just going to see more of in the 90s as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Lots of good clothing coordination for everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Which is also very kind of, kids book illustration sort of thing. I'm sure that was the idea.
Yeah, no, 100%. I could agree with that assumption. I'm going to suggest something, and you might take offense to it.
Is it a hot take?
No, it's not.
Is it a hot take on a 19-year-old movie? Sorry, continue.
No, I just, not to the same level of degree of quality, but I did get some, like, Wes Anderson-y vibes throughout this.
I could see that.
Yeah, like, it's, again, well, thematically, we have smart children. At least it's very smart child for our protagonist. And Janie's pretty smart too, I guess. Rich people in Upper East Side, New York. Mm-hmm. We even get our underwater shot.
Yeah.
And some really good symmetrical shots. The one of her near the beginning when the bell rings and they all start going into the screen and she goes over and sits in front of the other doors and just starts making her notes. Yeah. Like they're all going to class to learn and she's educating herself. Mm-hmm. She's very independent in that way. I like that a lot.
Yeah, and I did think of Rushmore during the movie as well. It's like the find the thing you love and do that for the rest of your life sort of thing. That's certainly an idea that exists in this movie.
It's like and there's a lot of Mean Girls I found as well.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a Burn Book in this movie. Yeah. There's a Burn Book and a cast member from Mean Girls in this film.
Yes, Laura Peters appears in both. Yeah, the Burn Book, the one-person Burn Book in this case.
Yeah.
Many of which burns are not burns at all, but okay. And as we get in a lot of school movies, we kind of get the quick rundown of all the kids or all the cliques.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's also the Burns in this film.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It's like a Mean Girls directed by a Wes Anderson, but way less talented on all fronts.
Yeah, exactly. And directed by a very early Wes Anderson, because I think 96 is the year Bottle Rocket comes out.
That's what I mean. It doesn't all add.
The math is faulty, but I see where you're coming from. So,
I thought there were a couple good shots. Like that one of her...
her going into the water, you pointed that out. I really like that shot.
Yeah, that's a good little bit.
Because it's a pretty abstract shot.
Yeah, and it gets to another thing I want to talk about, which is, and kind of lines up with some of the Wes Anderson stuff, is just, it is a funny movie, but it's pretty heavy at times. Like, this is, I know you said you kind of appreciate the honesty that the film kind of deals with kids bullying and stuff, but it's just heavy at times. And
yeah.
Making light of any situation, but it does oscillate between these very light, kids drinking wish soda, whatever that was at the start. There's like a child playing montage and, just as you said, those quick cuts and very colorful and nice and playful stuff. But it gets pretty dark at times, no?
And in the first 10 minutes, there are multiple references of suicide and also the Harriet's line about her teacher being nice and polite. When she murders a bunch of people, the police will come and ask her neighbors and they'll say, she was nice and polite. Like, which is a super dark, like, that's really funny to me. That's probably my favorite like joke line in the movie. I think it's really funny, but is also incredibly dark because it suggests that her teacher is a future murderer. You know?
Yeah.
So
a future mass murderer.
Yeah, exactly. So what I'm saying is I understand exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, and there's like that bathtub scene, I think, is really heavy. And I don't know how deliberate any indications of suicidal thoughts are in there. Do you get that? Or is that just me being like looking for way too much in this movie?
I think that's it's language. It's like coded language that exists that I don't necessarily know is intentional.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, that part is definitely meant to be, you know, a downbeat on the movie. Yeah. So maybe not quite to the suicidal level, but you're right. There are just things throughout this movie, you know, if I was known only by my footwear, I'd hang myself.
Yeah. Yeah.
That thing about the mother, the teacher being a murderer. She's looking at those weird death photos at one point as she's flipping through her book in class. Mm-hmm. And the tomato sandwiches we've mentioned. This one is really just in passing, so it's hard. But then I just reading it over, she said, as she's trying to, I guess she's using a butter knife to try to slice these tomatoes for a sandwich.
Yep.
And she says, just give me the big knife and this will all be over. Like, it's just all these kind of things that are just placed throughout. And even just reading that, you know, the to be or not to be speech from Hamlet.
Yeah.
That's, you know, a contemplation about how unpleasant life is and maybe death is better, maybe not.
Yeah.
And it's all played for laughs with Pinky Whitehead, you know, reading over dramatically and slowly. Yeah.
That's another one of the kids' movie moments that I actually enjoyed. I think that scene's pretty funny. Yeah. What he says, is that a question? For whatever reason, it gets me every time. And someone in the back, like, there's some good ADR in that scene as well, with someone in the background. I think she says kill me now or something. Yeah. But it gets me, man.
Yeah, there is some pretty well layered sound for some of the classroom moments.
Yeah.
But it's just this very pervasive sprinkling of suicidal thoughts and coded imagery that I think is I just don't know if they would do that anymore.
No, I don't think so. I think there's a lot in this film that, and I watched kids' movies regularly more like later into my life than I feel like most people do, but just because I see everything, and I kind of have stopped for the most part, except for Pixar movies, I suppose. But I strongly believe that they wouldn't be able to get it. They wouldn't try to pull a lot of these things now.
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's talk about that. Like, what else?
Mm.
I think someone gets called retarded in this movie.
That's by Harriet, no less. I think when they're suggesting games, Janie suggests. I don't even remember what game she suggests, and that's Harriet's response. I think there's just a lot in the when Golly comes back. That whole scene, they get a lot done real quick. None of which would happen in 2015, I don't think.
Which, refresh my memory?
It's when, when Harriet is at her lowest point and her parents bring Golly back. And her and Harriet have a pretty frank discussion about what happens. And I took notes of what Golly says, but I'm paraphrasing. But she wrote down you wrote down the truth and your friends weren't supposed to see it. Or your friends who weren't supposed to see it did. And now there are only two things to do and you're not going to like either one. You have to apologize and you have to lie. And then she explains why lying can be okay. And it just feels like this really kind of adult conversation about the meaning of truth and the importance of truth and the importance of things that are untrue sometimes. And I found that really interesting, and it doesn't seem like something that would exist in a modern kids movie. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are other things that I thought just looking at this purely through the lens of a kids movie, and especially hearing that it was banned from schools and other, you know, I was thinking about Catcher in the Rye, which is kind of famously banned from a lot of schools, and Just kind of some of the parallels between the main characters of these two texts. Mm-hmm. You know, they both see a psychiatrist at a point, which I think is a lot for, you know, young people. Mm-hmm. And again, people who are kind of, they really stick to themselves in so much. And I do appreciate that Catcher in the Rye is aimed at people several years older than Harriet the Spy, and their mm-hmm. protagonist's age reflect that much. But, you know, it's people who keep to themselves and people who generally feel really misunderstood and don't really feel the desire to fit in. And I think that's something in children's literature is such a mainstay, is to not do everything it takes to fit in with the cool people, but pro-social values of children's literature and children's film, like just to be part of the bigger picture. And this character seems, you know, kind of content to keep to herself until people start bullying her. You know, mm-hmm. That's the only time she really cares about being separate from other people. Mm-hmm. So what is the kind of really fundamental pro-social value in this movie, or is there one? Like, I think it's interesting what you've said about this movie dealing with the truth, because mm-hmm. I think that children's literature and children's film really almost always presents the idea that truth
yeah.
is the right way above all things, just be honest. And this plays with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of Harriet's last lines in the movie is something, it's in a retraction, it's something along the lines of she's talking about what's in the, I'll just keep calling it a burn book. She says, you know, a lot of those things were lies, and those that weren't lies were mean. You know, like, she's not denying the truth of some of her statements. She's just saying that they were mean statements, you know, like, she thinks they might still, or they still are objectively true. And she just doesn't, she wishes she hadn't said them, but it doesn't mean they're not true.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that really puts forth this very adult idea that not everyone's going to get along.
Yeah.
Like, you don't see that a lot in kid stuff. Like, the way that she and Marion never make up, there's mm-hmm. never that scene. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just like you said, the things that, the ones that weren't true, you know, they might be mean, as you said, the second one. And, sorry. Oh, yeah. The other one where Gully, after having a conversation with Gully, she says, Harriet says that some things are broken and some things are supposed to, and some things that are broken. Stuff you thought was broken forever isn't. And some yep. stuff, like, there's this idea that you and Marion are just never going to be friends, that mm-hmm. you have these opinions and they're not always going to line up with other people's opinions. And, you know, you don't go forcing it on other people, but there's just not going to be a total agreement between everyone. And that just seems like a message you don't get, that you don't hear often.
Yeah, absolutely. And also along the same lines, she says, some things are supposed to fall apart as the Spycatchers Club is falling apart. But that's also about the fact that, you know, nothing stays in your life. Nothing will stay forever. Gully won't come back permanently. She might come back for a visit, but she doesn't move backwards. She only goes forwards, you know, and she is no longer your nanny. You have to start dealing with a post Gully life, you know?
Yeah. So. So I think it's worth pointing out that, you know, since we're on the subject of Gully's exit, mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier that this, just like the suicide, a bunch of sex stuff in it. Mm-hmm. It's a coming of age story, obviously. I don't think that's up for debate. Mm-hmm. But we don't really get that sex stuff until Gully leaves. Mm-hmm. Like, there isn't any real talk of even romance or kind of adult love or that kind of romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. Until that point. And, you know, I think it's worth mentioning that what sets that all in motion is Gully goes on a date. Gully has, you know, what we assume to be a romantic attraction to this man, mm-hmm. You know, judging by the hand holding and popcorn feeding that goes on in Harriet's
and bratwurst maker.
Yeah, it's too much to chagrin. A good phallic meal for everybody.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they go, you know, they go to the movies together. They go see Mata Hari, you know, a movie about a very, you know, it's a femme fatale festival. So I don't think I need to say more about kind of the themes of those movies that we're dealing with and, you know, powerful women and their sexuality. And, you know, that's kind of, it's all that really kicks up this kind of first act plot of Gali leaving. Like that's what kind of sets this all in motion. And then after that, you know, the movies they're watching in class are girl to woman and boy to man. And just, there's so many other things, like just to bring up sexuality or romance and things that you might not necessarily pick up on as a kid. Like, the Asian family that she visits at Hong Fat's grocery store.
Yep.
After the boy takes the car out and crashes it on his date, you know, his mom asks, was the date worth it? He kind of laughs and says, oh, yeah, like, you know, implies sexuality very heavily there. And it's Janie's mom's bra that explodes. And there's all this coded language and imagery for sexuality. And I don't know if it's just, you know, especially the bra thing, is it just kind of the naughtiest, funniest thing for a kid? Or are we really looking at this as a sexual awakening thing too?
I think the sexual awakening thing is less there than the depression angle. I think it's there, but I think the zaniness factor does come into play with the with the choice of bra for science experiments. Yeah,
but the sexuality at the movies she's watching, the very explicit you know, puberty movies that they're watching in school.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and in fairness to the movie, well, I mean, it's not even that I need to defend it, but they watch one of those puberty movies before Gully goes away. Yeah, I don't know. I suppose I haven't thought about it, so I trust your opinion on it, or your reading of it.
No, don't trust my opinion on it. It's tough for me because we did with the Sandlot too. It's a movie about children around that age. But we found a very clear kind of sexual through line to this whole movie. And I think with the Sandlot that they hit it more on the head because they speak more about, you know, their attraction to this bodyguard, this lifeguard, and, you know, kind of looking at bodies in a very kind of male gaze desire kind of way.
Uh-huh. And they talk about pickling the beast frequently.
And I mean, I don't know if this is just me reading too much into it or if it's there in the movie, but it doesn't seem as strong because Harriet's never the one to really vocalize it because we never hear about her being attracted to anyone, male or female. But then there's just choices of words that after Gali goes away, you know, for this reading of it, we'll call that her, you know, girl to woman moment, to put it delicately. Gali conspicuously dressed in all red. And she goes, Harriet goes over to the cat man's house and they've taken all his cats away. I guess he wasn't treating them well, but the man taking them away in the single bag is treating them very well.
I know. Apparently. Cats are meant to be kept in a bag. Apparently, in the universe of Harriet the Spy, I am in charge of animal rights.
Well, you two have a lot going for you guys.
Although I hate hats, so that theory already has got holes in it.
That's right. No, but she says, you know, walking around, she's kind of at one of her low points. I think that point, and when she, oddly enough, it's when she says that really mean thing to Marion about her dad is when she gets the lowest, which is something I really like too. It's not when she's victimized the most. It's when she kind of makes a monster of herself that she really feels bad about herself.
Yep.
I thought that was nice. But, you know, she goes over to the cat man's house and she said, something's different. Everything looks the same, feels the same, smells the same, but it's different. And he looks in on Mr. Whittles and his cats. And she says, they finally nailed him. I'll always remember that face. It's the face you make when you really lose something. And I don't know. It just
seems. I'm on board.
Yeah.
You started to have, when you said Golly was wearing all red, you started to have me, and now I'm fully on board.
Yeah, and it's just kind of, I see it a lot, and I just don't know if I'm there, and I'm just playing with words for synonyms to make this movie that I've been pushing to do a podcast for seem to have more to it than it does. But
no, I'm on board.
There's lots of that.
Yeah. No.
They, one of the other really movie for me is when,
sorry, you cut out for a sec.
Oh, sorry. One of the other uncomfortable parts of this movie for me is when they spill the blue paint on her, mm-hmm. and we kind of get that scene of her, and it's just her face, and we just see like hands touching her body, and she yeah. just like, it's this very kind of personal space invasive thing. And yeah, I think on its own, I can see it as, you know, me saying, you know, you can find this kind of stuff in every movie if you look hard enough. But mm-hmm. just the way that those suicidal things are sprinkled in, and I think that those things about, you know, the boy's car crash or his date being worth it, nailing it, you know, the face when you really lose something. I think that there's enough, like, just below the surface that it's never gross or, you know, or over the line, but there is that reading kind of barely under the surface that I think people in a few years beyond the age of our protagonist here really start to understand.
Yeah. Yeah.
That makes sense?
Yes. No, it does make sense.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Sweet. Okay. we sometimes like to rank our TV and film parents. How do you think these ones did?
I don't know, because I mean,
you don't see a ton of them.
No, and I feel like taking away Notebooks is pretty. That's, I don't know. That's a type of, I don't know. It seems like such a mild depression that, like, what's the worst that could happen if the kid has a notebook, sort of thing.
Well, I guess we've seen it for a second.
We have, but I don't know.
Her getting patted down in front of her class is a whole.
Well, yeah.
That's just awful.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose I don't have a cinematic parental ranking here.
Okay, so not as good as Boy Meets World, but
no.
Okay,
and they're not Coach and Mrs. Coach. I will say that they certainly do not receive the esteemed rating of Coach and Mrs. Coach.
How likable is Harriet overall? We kind of fall into that trap of she's a protagonist, so we don't really have a give her a fair take. We just like her because we follow her.
I would say she's very likable because she has a lot of qualities that I appreciate in a person. I don't know that she's
she's judgmental.
Yeah. that's part of it. She doesn't necessarily, like, she is an honest person that doesn't always understand when
honesty isn't the best policy.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not even necessarily that she's like such a stickler for truth. It's just that, like, she doesn't understand why not to be honest. She's like, well, that's how I see it, so I'm gonna say it as such, and I don't understand why people hearing these words or reading these words don't understand it, you know, or don't understand the honesty there. So yeah, I certainly can see how people would find her unlikable. I think her unlikable traits are exactly what make me like her.
So everyone who doesn't like Harriet will not like you as a person. Yeah,
I mean, I really don't think it's that far. It's that far of a jump. Yeah.
So kind of knowing that, can you disagree? I think one of the things you liked about this is that it deals with the truth in a way that's not so black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of telling Harriet not to be Harriet. So yeah. How do you
it's line not,
up those feelings?
It's not necessarily telling her not to be Harriet. It's telling her to be more careful about being Harriet, which I honestly think is kind of the truth.
Be 100% Harriet. Don't play games.
Well, just be 100% Harriet. Just don't lose the book. or the notebook. Sorry. Yeah, because I don't know that there's a huge change in the way that Harriet's going to live her life. I feel like she understands at the end of the movie that there are some things, and this is something I would say is definitely true. There are some things that where, you know, the truth is obvious, the truth still doesn't need to be said. I think that's one of my favorite points in the movie. And I think that is something that is an important lesson for, you know, an 11 or 12 year old or however old Harriet is to learn, is that, you know, the truth is important, but not always the most important. It's I think her last line in the movie is, the truth is important and so are your friends. If you can have them both, then it's a good life, you know. But it's not necessarily saying that you're always gonna have both. You kind of sometimes need to pick your spots. And you know what she says about sport is true in the book. I think she says is that sport doesn't have a lot of money and that he cooks and cleans, right? I'm not that far off with that.
No, you are incorrect. This is one of my, I have a few big plot problems with this movie, which, okay, if it isn't clear yet, overall, I adore this movie. but yeah, that's the problem. It's so counterintuitive. What he reads is, my friend was nice enough to give, you know, paraphrase, that's really what he's saying, and everyone freaks out. And I understand how that's embarrassing, and of how she said in front of a bunch of people, oh, sport's so poor, I had to give him a bunch of money just to eat, then that's bad. She writes about how his dad should just have a regular job so he can support the family at one point. Mm-hmm. But that's not what gets kind of read in the big burn book reveal moment, that her questioning of his father is somewhat judgmental. But the, you know, the empirical fact that she gave him a dollar one time, to me, is a sign of friendship, not the opposite.
Yeah. 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 Okay. Fair enough.
So to derail your
point derailed. Okay. But no, I just know that some of the things that she says in the notebook are as close to being objectively true, like you said, about her giving him a dollar as possible. And she still gets, you know, has to pay for some of these things. But yeah, I think the most important thing that the movie tries to get out of us, or to, you know, have us leaving the theater thinking, is that, quote unquote, the truth is important and so are your friends, you know. It's not always worth being 100% honest if it means you and sport can't hang out anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of the takeaways is, and again, one of my big problems with this movie is that it wraps up too quickly and too tidily. Like our boy Dov, boy with the purple socks.
Dov Tiefenbach.
Dov Tiefenbach.
Canadian legend.
His whole speech about, you know, if we only listen to one person, we never.
Oh, yeah. The Silent Bob moment.
Yeah, it's garbage.
Yeah. Like, Silent Bob moments are garbage.
Well, it's garbage because it's not built too properly. Like, I think the scene is missing where Harriet, and I don't mean the scene is missing like this was in the script and got deleted. I think this is just something that I would think makes sense. She writes a paper that's an unofficial, you know, grade 6 paper or whatever, while Marion is school president and thereby editor of that paper. Mm-hmm. Harriet writes her own edition where she talks about everything great and all those people she observed, including her classmates, which kind of happens at the end where she talks about all the other people on her route being better people. You just have to look closely. That scene kind of needs to exist for everybody in the class. And then everyone sees Harriet's using her observation for good sometimes, and that Marion just sucks. And then we can have her be the editor of the official paper. Anyway, what I think is a takeaway is this idea of you have to do more than observe and you have to be your own person. Like it's when she's creative and uses her words to not just write down what she sees, but putting that all together to say something, to make her point.
Yeah.
And that's when she stops calling herself a spy and starts calling herself Harriet M. Welsh. Like you can't just be reflections of other people. And you know, you get that as a child, you kind of just look at other people and mimic what they do. And I think the coming of age moment is when you kind of move past that and say, this is who I really am. And it's something that she kind of claims to be about this whole time. She says, you know, she spells it out to her parents often, you know, as you described earlier, this is who I am, this is what I like, I have different hobbies and activities and interests, but I'm, you know, fine, and this is what works for me. Mm-hmm. But I think that she isn't really owning that personality. I think she knows that's the right thing to do. But all she does is walk around and take down these, you know, these notes on other people. Mm-hmm. But then eventually she does something with it. She does something creative. She gets the paper on her own and she writes these things and she uses her, you know, skill with words, because she says she wants to be a writer one day, an author, mm-hmm. To do something that brings people together and brings the class together and let everyone understand, you know, her powers of observation have been used for good as well, and that she's an astute observer and not just someone who judges people. You know, she's a journalist, not TMZ. essentially, that's kind of what I think, like, the message for someone in this position is. It's like, yeah, you everyone can watch people. It's what do you do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also, I mean, the idea of words having power is all throughout this movie, and there are so many writers in this movie. Well, when I say so many, I mean at least three, or four, I guess, if we're counting Marion.
And we see her writing in her notebook really early on. Like, we see her handwriting, we see her spelling things out as she spells things out to other characters, like her parents throughout the movie.
Yeah, dad's a writer, Harriet's dad is a writer.
Yeah, and it's all like, yeah, exactly. It's all very personal. We get this writing very early. But yeah, like, there's writers throughout this, and we deal with a few, you know, we deal with Shakespeare as well. Sorry,
yeah.
Continue though.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I mean, what sets everything in motion for Harriet? Golly gets fired. What happens if Golly writes a note? She probably doesn't get fired, you know, if she just leaves a note for the parents and says, we went to the Eglinton Grand to go see a movie, you know? So yeah, it's like, even the removal of words and, you know, like, truthfully, that's all Golly should have done, is just write a note saying we went out to a movie. I'm sure her parents are fine with it, because her parents immediately regret firing her, or her mother does.
Yeah.
Because at the second that logic starts to come back in, they're like, no, this is insane. This is one screw up over the course of 11 years.
Yeah.
You know, like, this is okay. Rosie can stay. Yeah. And it's just this one slip up where Golly fails to use her words properly to convey an idea to the parents that loses her job and sets things in motion for Harriet. And she then, towards the end of the movie, spurs Harriet on to actually write something with meaning, the thing that you were talking about. Don't just use your observations to just write things, like, put them together to mean something. You know?
Yeah. Did you notice the message in the background when they're walking to Mrs. W's garden near the beginning?
Is it there are all these different lives and they need to be, you've got to take a closer look, that one?
That scene, but as they're walking towards it, it shows up one word at a time on like five, six different signposts.
That, oh, no.
Says, oh, okay. So it's an Einstein quote, and it's really like word for word. So you really have to pay attention. And I had to rewatch it to pick it all up, but it says, imagination is more powerful imagination is more important than knowledge. And, you know, I think that gets to that point of, you know, doing more than observing. Be your own person. You don't just reflect these things, but take these things around you and kind of make them into something more useful. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's a message from, you know, Louise Fitzhugh, who wrote the novel in the 60s. You know, that's just kind of, and still works in the 90s and still obviously holds up now. It's just this idea that anyone can take down what's happening around them, but it's about finding what's important about that and, you know, putting forth the best ideas in the best way. And that's the growth you need to experience, not just seeing more, but experiencing more and doing more with those experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
anything else about Harriet the Spy?
No, I think that's a good idea.
Remember how orange that tape was, bro?
Oh, bro, it's so orange. It's also covered in dust. Thank you for listening to MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check back next time for our next episode.
Thanks for listening to the MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.